New views, new look, new name. It's time for Macro Pulse. Here's what matters. Live from New York City, I'm Lauren Goodwin, and this is Market Matters from New York Life Investments. In this podcast, we bring you the best insights from across the New York Life Investments platform because we believe that by sharing perspectives and engaging with you, our listeners, we can all become better investors. Welcome, everyone. It's the week of April 15th, 2024, and today is a big day, and not just because it's tax day. File those extensions, folks, if you're in the U.S., but because we, and by we, I mean myself, Julia Herman, and Macro Michael Galbo, are launching our new Outlook series. From here on out, we'll be publicly sharing a monthly refresh, at least, of our holistic global, economic, geopolitical, and asset allocation views.
We've been covering all of these topics separately, and we're pulling them together in what we call Macro Pulse. You can find the full reader deck online, refreshed monthly, at newyorklifeinvestments.com/global-markets. And every quarter, we'll be here on the podcast sharing our updates with you.
We are so proud of this piece of work, and we're even more excited to share it with you all today, particularly because this cycle has been so hard for investors of all types to navigate.
In the past 6 months in the U.S., we've seen steady disinflation, economic activity has held up well, and expectations for interest rate cuts have been supporting risk assets. The top question we receive from investors is whether our team believes this cycle will end in a soft landing or a hard landing or recession. And our answer is both. We believe these past 6 months have been a soft landing for the economy, but we see this phase as a stop on the way to recession.
So today, on this episode and in our Macro Pulse piece, we explain exactly why and how that can be the case, that we have both a soft landing and a hard landing. We'll cover our latest views on the global economic cycle today, and then next week we'll be giving a comprehensive update of our asset allocation insights. So with that, let's start on the economic cycle. Some of our listeners may be familiar with the framework we use to describe how an economy slows in response to interest rate hikes, a series of economic dominoes, if you will, showing how economic data points fall in a relatively predictable pattern across all different economic cycles. We first saw interest rate sensitive sectors such as housing and manufacturing react to higher interest rates as early as 2022. Then, in the later phase of an economic slowdown, we typically see corporate profits, consumer activity, and finally the labor market begin to slow down. In those areas, we're starting to see cracks on the surface, but the issue for investors has been that this cycle has been stuck at that middle point, corporate profits, for more than a year. And to talk about why, I'd like to set up a debate between Julia and Macro Mike. So, Mike, I'd like to put to you to argue the case for an economic slowdown. And Julia, for you, I'd like you to debate him on why the economy has been strong and might be expected to remain so. Now, I want to note that neither of these people necessarily chose their perspective arguments, but we try when we're working through really difficult economic debates to do this in real time, to take an objective stance of if something were to go right or something were to go wrong, what would it look like? So thank you each for playing the role.
I'm happy to take the recessionary case here. Anyone who thinks that the U.S. economy hasn't reacted to higher rates is kidding themselves. You mentioned that interest rate sensitive sectors are typically the first to react to Fed hikes, and this cycle was a classic example of that. In 2022, in just 9 months of Fed hikes, the housing market nearly ground to a halt. We've seen a few bumps on that road since, but given that new mortgages will run a family about 7% right now, activity in this space has been incredibly weak. Sellers don't want to give up their 4%, buyers don't want to pay 7%, and therefore the housing market is frozen. Industrial production as well, shedding light on the manufacturing side of the economy, has also slowed to near 0% growth over the past year.
But you're only mentioning one side of the manufacturing coin there, Mike. The other side of it, manufacturing PMIs or purchasing managers indices, did react very strongly to that initial hiking cycle, but just this past month crossed the neutral threshold and entered slightly positive sentiment territory in March.
I'll give you that this is something to watch if it's a case of the domino standing back up, or in other words, a case of economic data beginning to reaccelerate.
I wonder if some of the inflation data out from last week can shed light on this data point. Last week, the March Consumer Price Index showed that inflation is still sticky. But the following day, producer price inflation, the wholesale cost that producers pay for their inputs, came in softer than expected. So if you add these together for manufacturers, it may point to a unique time when their pricing power is still solid, but input costs are finally softening. I mean, if I were in the manufacturing space, which I'm not, this would certainly help my own sentiment about how things were going, perhaps contributing to that higher purchasing managers index that we saw a couple weeks before.
It's a really interesting story for March, but it's just 1 month of data. There are 2 years worth of trends showing how the economy has slowed in response to interest rates. And the last one of these I want to mention is that services sentiment has steadily trended lower since the very first Fed hike in March 2022.
Okay, so looking backward, we have a few well-defined areas that have slowed, such as housing, manufacturing, in reaction to interest rates. But we're watching for any sustained signs of a resurgence, including in manufacturing, as Julia pointed out. Right now, we're at the stage in the cycle where we expect cracks to be emerging in corporate profit growth. But what we see instead is a moderate muddle-through situation in corporate profitability data. Looking under the hood, we can see that corporations are facing some headwinds from slowing demand and higher input costs, but are still benefiting from relatively resilient consumer demand and a disciplined approach to their bottom lines. I think this encapsulates really well the debate about the state of the economy for the rest of the year, and I'd like the two of you to duke it out a bit further. In the tightrope between slowing growth, but growth that's still resilient, corporations are caught right in the middle. So what are your views on that circumstance? What can we say about the consumer, the demand for goods that those corporations are selling?
I'm going to argue that the next move for the consumer is a leg down. In short, consumers have lost their backstop of excess savings from the pandemic, and that's because they were unable to keep up their savings in the face of high inflation, a statement that is all the more strong when wage growth has been historically high at around 4% growth. Seeing consumer figures hold up, presumably because folks are not saving at all or racking up credit card debt, does not provide me much comfort about the health of the economy.
But those pockets of stress are just that, they're pockets. We're seeing credit card balances and delinquencies rise, yes, but really only amongst younger folks and lower income folks, exactly those that unfortunately are least able to cope with an inflationary environment. We're seeing just as many pockets of astounding strength, in my view. And that's because while some consumers are feeling that heat of rising credit card interest rates, other households, like you had mentioned, people don't want to give up that 4% mortgage rate. Other households that own their homes have hardly seen their debt financing costs rise because they have fixed rate mortgages. So not only should this perhaps make us feel confident that we're not on the precipice of a housing crisis like we were back in the global financial crisis, but it also means that older consumers, those homeowners, the so-called boomers, have been able to keep their spending up at a time when otherwise we would likely be expecting it to slow and contribute to a broader demand slowdown.
Okay, so when it comes to aggregate demand, it sounds like we have a case of the haves and the have-nots, a split in consumer resilience between those lower income and higher income consumers. If that's the case, is it also true for corporations? Do we have a bifurcation there as well?
It looks like it. Small businesses are certainly feeling the heat. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is a proxy for small business associations, is showing an optimism index that's low enough to align with the post-global financial crisis era and a brief period in the 1980s. These small businesses point out that hiring is difficult and expensive. And anecdotally, we've seen evidence that financing costs are rising for these small businesses.
So small businesses are feeling the heat, but for large corporations, which comprise the other half of private employment in the U.S., we're seeing resilience. Lauren, you mentioned that corporate profits have been muddling through. And I'd like to point out two reasons that can support this. The first is COVID-era refinancing, which has allowed large corporations to push back when their debt is due, and to keep their costs on that debt fixed and low. Contributor number two to large corporate resilience is liquidity. Cash levels as a percentage of short-term liabilities are still near historically high levels that were last seen around the year 2000. And prior to that, not since World War II.
So we're seeing some trends here in both the consumer and business environment. There's some haves and have-nots. The haves are supported still to this day by pandemic era programs, not necessarily handouts or cash payments at this point, but interest rate programs that have allowed them to keep their costs lower for longer. Julia, you noted that large corporations comprise the other half of private employment in the U.S. So if employment is basically split between small business, which is struggling, relatively speaking, and relatively large, resilient corporations, we need to parse out what the net impact would be on the labor market. Are we starting to see cracks there?
We do. And I want to point out that the labor market is the most lagging economic indicator of the economic cycle. This means that when the labor data truly shows signs of weakness, it means that we're already in recession. So at this stage in the cycle, which we believe is a slowing economy that is not yet in recession, we do not expect to see wholesale labor weakness. We expect to see cracks emerging, which is exactly what we're seeing. Leading indicators of employment are deteriorating, like the number of weekly hours worked on average and small business hiring plans.
I mean, that might be the case for small business employment, but at the national level, wage growth just isn't giving up. Average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis are still around 4%, which is a solid percentage point or more above the pre-COVID era average rate of wage growth. And I think this wage growth is a huge part of what's holding up the consumer this cycle.
Let me put a bow on this debate. You both have encompassed incredibly well the tightrope that the economy is on. And we see areas of weakness that have responded to higher interest rates and areas of relative strength, some that we'd expect at this stage in the economic cycle to be slowing down, some that we wouldn't. I want to make our team's view very clear, reiterating what Julia said at the top. We are sticking to our recession view. In the past few months, we've seen some strong inflation prints and strong jobs data. And although these have supported sentiment and market performance in the short term, they also weaken the case for policy support for Fed cuts. So in this sense, the possibility of the economy slowing more notably and sooner is not the bear case view for the year, in our view. A more mild and immediate recession could actually support a durable decline in inflation and help rationalize some of the market performance we've seen so far. So, Mike, you were tasked with the slowdown part of the debate. What would you say is the bear case for this year?
Probably overheating. The longer interest rates remain at restrictive levels, the more concerned we become about a possible banking sector hiccup, commercial real estate stress, and just a generally more deep recession.
We just received the third consecutive month of warmer than expected inflation. So how concerning or immediate is this overheating risk?
We're not there yet, but with every month of strong inflation, the harder it becomes for inflation to come back down to reasonable levels within the year. What I mean by this is that if core inflation continues at a pace, even just 0.2% growth each month, inflation will end the year at current levels. This means consumers have not felt an area of price relief for about 3 years now.
Okay, so the economy is on a tightrope. We're sticking to our recession view. We believe the worst case economic and outcome and the more challenging case for positioning for investors this year would actually be a reacceleration or a reheating of the economy. And this has all been very U.S. focused so far, but our work is global. So I want to bring in some of the global cycle views here, not least because if the Fed is keeping rates where they are, but other central banks are starting to cut, that impacts investor outcomes, right? So, Julia, lots of reports say that Europe is already in recession. Could you give us a little detail on the global picture?
Yes, the euro area, or at least Germany, is already in recession. Given the fears that we and our European partners had for prospects about European growth when Russia first invaded Ukraine, Europe has been relatively more resilient to higher energy costs than many of us feared. But still, we would expect the European Central Bank to lead the way ahead of the Fed, if necessary, on interest rate cuts because we see the European economy in more need of that support.
Well, if Europe could potentially be starting to cut rates before the US, we have one central bank at least, which is moving in the opposite direction, which is Japan. So how about Japan? The country has been focusing on corporate profitability and has seen some of the fastest wage growth in quite a long time. And relevant to this interest rate story, it also made the historic end to its negative interest rate policy just last month. So these factors point to growth has been higher, right?
All those factors are exactly right, Lauren. And so many investors might be surprised to know that technically Japan is in a recession. But from the investment perspective, the country's focus on profitability and policy normalization are very encouraging signs.
Finally, I know we just covered the geopolitical aspect of our China analysis last week, but can you share an update on China's economic status while we're on the topic?
So China's an emerging market, so let's consider that context first. Many EMs were the first to hike during the pandemic, and some have beaten the Fed to interest rate cuts. Given that we just emerged from a global pandemic, I'm impressed by the resilience that we've seen here.
I'm sensing a but.
But a common saying amongst emerging markets investors is, when the U.S. sneezes, emerging markets catch a cold. And in this cycle, we see China, the U.S., and the euro area all sneezing, or slowing down, if you will. The implication of emerging markets catching a cold is that they'll feel a more marked and potentially painful slowdown in response to seeing the same in developed markets. Starting with China, this global trade powerhouse is reckoning with its credit-driven growth model. It's facing a slow and painful deleveraging of its real estate and infrastructure sectors. Its equity markets have been heavier than lead. And yet it is still not enacting policies to attract foreign capital to potentially offset some of this. We say in the US, don't fight the Fed. In China, I'd say don't fight policy. And policy is allowing for a gradual growth deceleration.
There you have it, folks, our full set of global views relating to the economic cycle. And I know that this is a lot to talk about in just a few minutes on a podcast. So I really encourage you, if these are topics that are interesting you, to check out the Macro Pulse piece. It's really cool, comprehensive, I think interesting. And we focus on takeaways for investors throughout. So it can be very actionable for those who are looking through that type of resource. Coming up next, we'll share our full tour of latest asset allocation themes and our preferred asset classes. But that's it for today. We'll be back next week for more Market Matters. In the meantime, please remember to give us a like, follow, or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a question or topic of interest, reach out to us on LinkedIn. We really do use those questions to think about our topics for the pod. And you can follow our views, including the Macro Pulse piece and webinars related to that content, at newyorklifeinvestments.com/global-markets. Until then, I'm Lauren Goodwin here with Julia Herman and Macro Mike Legalbo today. We'll see you next week. All investments are subject to market risk and will fluctuate in value. Diversification cannot assure a profit or protect against loss in a declining market. The opinions expressed are those of the Global Market Strategy Team of New York Life Investment Management, LLC, and not necessarily those of other investment boutiques affiliated with New York Life Investments. This information should not be relied upon by the reader as research or investment advice regarding any strategy, and there's no guarantee that any strategies discussed will be effective. New York Life Investments is both a service mark and the common trade name of certain investment advisors affiliated with the New York Life Insurance Company, New York, New York, 10010.